This week in Linux, we have a lot of cool stuff to talk about. First, we're going to talk about the future of KDE Plasma. Then we're going to go into the future of OpenSUSE because Leap 16 beta has been released and the final version will be coming out this year. Then we'll also have a new version of Mozilla Firefox. And also we have some interesting news from the Oregon State University because there's some potential risk of closure of their open source lab, which would be a shame. And then we're also going to talk about Redis because they're back in the news this week because they want to redo with open source. All of this and more on This Week in Linux, the weekly news show that keeps you up to date with what's going on in the Linux and open source world. Now let's jump right into your source for Linux good news. This episode of Twill is sponsored by Sandfly. More on them later. The KDE team just had a development sprint in Graz, Austria, and there's some significant changes coming to KDE Plasma. First up, well, Plasma LTS will be discontinued. They say that our conclusion was that the fairly limited nature of the product isn't meeting anyone's expectations, so we decided to not continue it. Instead, we'll lengthen the effective support period of normal Plasma releases a bit by adding on an extra bug fix release, taking us from 5 to 6. I think this is actually interesting because the long-term support never really made sense to me because they were saying that they wanted to go from every 4 months to every 6 months, because once the system gets more and more stable and more production ready and all that sort of stuff, because it is already production ready, but at the same time, it's like the goal is to kind of get it to a point where a long-term support makes sense, but they've had a long-term support since before that change. So they're doing a 4 month release instead of a 6 month release. And they eventually want to do a 6 month release. So I think it makes sense for them to change until that point happens. So This makes sense to me, but if you rely on the stability of long-term support releases, this means KDE is kind of shifting its strategy. I think the only LTS version right now is KDE Plasma 5, which is a good example of why the LTS is not going to be making sense, because Plasma 5 and Plasma 6 are very different. But yeah, we'll see what happens in the future related to the LTS. They might bring it back, but I think it makes sense for the current process of KDE Plasma. Also, they are discussing the end of QML theming. So this move is aimed at improving the stability and security of Plasma desktop experience. The issue here is that QML-based theming is just kind of dangerous. They say that it is inherently dangerous because QML is code and there's not really a way to make QML theming safe. So we're working on moving away from it. So basically, you can, by running this theme, you're running code on your system rather than just installing, you know, icons and color settings and stuff like that. So it could be a little bit dangerous. And they actually talked about on the blog post that there was a data loss issue caused by a faulty third-party global theme. And to prevent similar problems, KDE is phasing out QML-based theming in critical areas like lock screen, OSDs, on-screen display, splash screens, and other things like login screens as well. While some QML will remain for things like widgets and stuff like that, the plan is to sandbox those for added safety. They also talked about the distribution channel of store.kde.org, which is exposed for access for people who see the get new stuff, like get new themes or get new icons or whatever dialogues that are inside of the system settings or some KDE applications. But what some might not know is that in their blog post, they're saying that this is not actually owned by KDE. It's simply a front end to the Pling.com service. When you go to Pling.com and you go to KDE Store, you can tell that's absolutely the same thing. But they say that that's one of the issues. People think that it is owned by KDE and it's not. Now, to be fair, the reason why they think that is because it's store.kde.org. And why else would it be store.kde.org? But some other concerns include the lack of approval required moderation for new content with stability or security implications. So lack of automatic linting for content to make sure it's valid, inability to specify a minimum Plasma versions for QML-based content, and some other issues. So I think it sounds like they should just get rid of support inside of Plasma for these things if it's that kind of problematic. And just make their own version or something like that. I don't know. I actually had the KDE store inside of a video I made about the like 17 tips in under 7 minutes or something. I forgot how I named it, but it was like things you didn't know you could do in KDE Plasma. And it sounds like this shouldn't be a thing you can do in KDE Plasma based on what they're talking about. So maybe that'll change. But also the last thing we're going to talk about is that KDE developers are looking to gain better insights into how their software is used. They say there was a broad agreement that the status quo is not ideal and that they collect very little data from people who have opted in because it's off by default and who don't have a path towards changing what data they collect in response to newly discovered questions that they would like answered. So to make more informed decisions about future development, KDE plans to adopt a telemetry system similar to the Steam Hardware Survey. This is opt-in approach will provide them more useful data on things like feature usage, allowing them to prioritize development efforts and address potential issues more effectively. I think this is good. I think that opt-out versus opt-in is a lot more complicated than people like assume it is. They think that opt-out is automatically a bad thing. Depending on how it's done, it can be done respectfully to the user. But a lot of companies don't do that, so it has a bad reputation. But this is an interesting way of doing it because the Steam Hardware Survey just kind of pops up randomly during your usage and it says, would you like to participate? And this is kind of like the same thing where it will just randomly pop up and ask you to participate in the KDE stuff. I think that they should do it more frequently or more broader than the way that Steam does it, because I've participated in the Steam Hardware Survey maybe 3-4 times in the past decade. So maybe a little more than that. Anyway, that's not all that's happening with the KDE world. Looking a bit further down the line, they are looking to make changes with activities. And there's also some exciting progress for Wayland stuff, because there's a thing called the Wayland Session Restore Protocol. And this is very cool. And KDE Plasma is targeting the next version of Plasma 6.4 to have some features related to this. And this is just super cool in the fact that you can essentially store all of your the applications you're running and where they're located on your workspace and how the size of them and all that sort of stuff inside of the session restore and be able to, like, just when you boot your system, have it all there, which is very cool. I like that a lot. So anyway, that's the future of KDE Plasma. Some significant shifts and exciting developments on the horizon for the tech landscape of KDE Plasma. What do you think about these changes? Let us know in the comments. The OpenSUSE project is gearing up for a major release with Leap 16.0, promising a blend of stability and modern features. The beta is now available and it's packed with significant changes. So here's what you need to know. The latest beta of OpenSUSE Leap marks a significant evolution for this very established Linux distro. So basically what it is that this beta is being of Leap 16 is based on SLE or SUSE Linux Enterprise 16. And this is now using the new base of SUSE Linux Framework 1 that was previously known as the Adaptable Linux Platform or ALP. This is kind of how Micro OS works. And this is a sort of immutable, but not really immutable-ish, immutable-like, read-only file system type of stuff. But it's not exactly what that term immutable means. I talked about this in a previous episode of the show and as well as in my podcast, Destination Linux. I'll have links in the show notes if you want more information about the immutability of stuff and what it actually means. But this is very cool because there's a huge difference between what Leap is now with 15 and what Leap will be based on the change of this SUSE Linux Framework 1. Several core components of OpenSUSE are seeing significant updates in this release. Besides being built on top of SLE 16, this is actually going to have some changes related to trying to work to be Wayland only while still clearing out some remaining Xorg remnants. So SysV init support has been dropped. The new Agama installer is used by default and replacing the traditional Yast stack is Cockpit and Merlin. The move to Wayland only aims for a more modern and potentially more performant display server. Dropping SysV init streamlines the boot process with systemd, and the new Agama installer promises better reusability and integration, while Cockpit and Merlin offer a more modular approach to system and software management compared to the monolithic Yast style. So Yast has been around for a very long time, and it's very useful. Some people will not be happy about the change of getting rid of Yast, but I think Cockpit is a very, very cool piece of software from Red Hat, and I'm really interested to see how SUSE has implemented Cockpit into their system. Now, it is worth noting that Yast is still available in Tumbleweed, but will no longer be developed. Yast has been removed from Leap 16, and Merlin takes on this role of software installation like Yast. If someone is interested in the maintenance of Yast for further development, the source is available on GitHub if you want. But Yast, while powerful, could be perceived as too complex, and that's why Cockpit offers a web-based interface for system administration, and Merlin focuses specifically on software package management, potentially providing a cleaner and more streamlined user experience for these things. OpenSUSE Leap 16.0 introduces a new minimum processor requirement and a more efficient way of managing software repositories. So Leap 16 will no longer run on machines that do not support x86-64-v2. Leap 16 now uses RIS-based repository management through the OpenSUSE repos package and is a system already familiar to users of Leap Micro 6. Leap 16 distribution repositories are now split per architecture, which makes metadata smaller and refreshes faster. Aside from that, Leap 16 beta contains experimental support for parallel package downloads in Zipper, speeding up installs and updates, which is very cool. The changes to Zipper, one of the issues that people had with Zipper is that it was kind of slow to do downloads because it didn't do parallel package downloads. And now that it is, this is going to be a big change for a lot of people. Now, requiring x86-64-v2 allows the distribution to leverage newer processor features for improved performance, and the RIS-based repository management and architecture-specific repositories aim to make software management faster and more efficient. And of course, there's a lot of core updates to various system components and desktop environments, including the Linux kernel is updated to 6.12, which I'm pretty sure is the LTS version, or current LTS version, and also GNOME 48 has been updated. KDE Plasma has updated to 6.3.4. GIMP has been updated to 3.0. AppArmor 4.1, and a lot more. These updates bring the latest features and improvements from the upstream projects, ensuring that you have access to modern and capable tools and desktop environments. Now, Leap is not known for having the fastest upgrade path. Now, I don't remember exactly, but I think it's about a 5-year gap between 15.0 and 16.0 of Leap. This is very cool. And maybe the whole framework one change or ALP change might make that faster. I'm very curious to see what happens there. Another big change is that Leap 16 follows SUSE Linux Enterprise, or SLE, in using SE Linux by default for security purposes. Unlike SLE, though, OpenSUSE will also provide AppArmor thanks to active community contributions. So this is really interesting. If you want to use AppArmor, you can, but SE Linux is very, very powerful, and is also, there's actually a funny meme about uninstalling or turning off or disabling SE Linux. Don't do that. If you see that in a tutorial, just don't do that. It's not a great tip. OpenSUSE Leap 16.0 is shaping up to be a significant release with core changes aimed at modernizing the distribution while retaining its stability. The beta is a great opportunity for the community to test these new features and provide feedback. And if you are an OpenSUSE user or just curious about the latest in the Linux world, I think it's time to check it out. And also, of course, I'll be keeping an eye on this for progress towards the final release, which is expected to happen sometime in June. For those of you who remember KDE Desktop 3.5, not Plasma, KDE 3 was not Plasma. That came out in Plasma 4. So KDE 4 technically was the first version of Plasma, although they still called it KDE 4. They didn't call it Plasma 4 yet. It was KDE Plasma 5 when they started actually calling it Plasma, but it was still called Plasma during the 4 days. Anyway, that doesn't matter. Get ready for a blast from the past that is still kicking, and that is the Trinity Desktop, because this is a continuation of the classic KDE 3.5, and they just dropped a new release. So let's see what's fresh in this retro-inspired desktop. The Trinity Desktop Environment, TDE, R14.1.4 is here, bringing a mix of updates and nostalgia for fans of the classic KDE 3.5 experience. This release focuses on stability and some new features, as well as broader compatibility. So the latest update to the Trinity desktop adds several user-facing improvements. The key highlights of this version are support for Unicode surrogate characters and planes above zero, new modern vector wallpapers and new color themes, new control module to manage deb/RPM alternatives, tab support in KPDF, clickable links in calendar events, support for transparency, top and shadow borders, and inactive windows in Decorator, ability to create VPN connections in the TDE Network Manager, as well as several improvements to the Codeine player. These enhancements bring a blend of modern functionality like emoji support and improved window effects to the familiar, or maybe not familiar, because it's been a long time. If you're not familiar with it, it makes sense because it's been almost two decades since KDE switched away from 3.5. But a lot of people still like it. And if that's you, then you might want to check out TDE. The new control module for alternatives and tab support in the PDF viewer improve usability, while the network manager and the media player updates add to the desktop's overall functionality. TDE has not been compatible with a lot of distributions. It's been kind of more of like the boutique type of distros, but they are adding support for Ubuntu 25.04 and the upcoming Fedora 43. And by adding support for the newest Ubuntu and Fedora releases, they're going to make it possible for more people to use their desktop. So TDE R14.1.4 is technically a maintenance update, but it has a lot of updates in there. They talk about it being a maintenance release, but there's a lot of improvements, and there's also support for more distros, which is always good. So it's a solid update for those who appreciate the Trinity desktop environment's lean and efficient approach based on the classic KDE 3.5. So with new features, broader compatibility, and ongoing development, this project might deserve some attention from those who haven't checked it out. And if that might be you, then you'll find links in the show notes. Now, for me, I don't mind the fact that Plasma is more modern these days. So I'm okay with leaving KDE 3.5 in the past. But if you like the nostalgia aspects of it, links in the show notes. As Linux users, we know what's up. Security is non-negotiable. But with threats getting smarter, your security tools need to keep pace without dragging your system down. Traditional agents, they slow you down, they leave blind spots. I mean, it's time for a smarter approach, and that is why This Week in Linux is proud to be sponsored by Sandfly Security, the revolutionary agentless platform designed for Linux. Sandfly doesn't just detect and respond. It revolutionizes security with SSH key tracking, password auditing, and drift detection, covering threats from every angle. Whether your systems are in the cloud, on-premises, or in embedded devices, Sandfly ensures they're all secure without the headaches of agent-based solutions. Listen to what Ken Kleiner, the senior security engineer at the University of Massachusetts, has to say. Sandfly is the first product that he's seen that accurately and quickly detects thousands of signs of compromise on the Linux platform. Its unique method automates tasks which would be manually impossible. Automation is key with detection, and Sandfly completely fits this and other requirements. If your organization is using Linux, this should be part of your cybersecurity toolset. So experience security that's not just effective, but gives you peace of mind. No agent, no downtime, just cutting-edge protection. Dive into the future of Linux security at thisweekinlinux.com/sandfly. That's thisweekinlinux.com/sandfly, and see how Sandfly can transform your security strategy. And if you're as fascinated by cybersecurity as much as I am, then go check out the interview that we had on Destination Linux with the CEO of Sandfly, who has an awesome story about how he got into Linux, how he got into security, and all sorts of stuff. We cover so many topics, including DEF CON and so much. So go check it out at destinationlinux.net/409 for that interview. And of course, thisweekinlinux.com/sandfly for more information. And also, if you want to get a discount, he gave us a discount for Destination 50. We'll give you 50% off the home edition of Sandfly. Firefox just dropped version 138, and it's packing some serious upgrades. From the long-awaited organizational tools to features that I didn't notice from version 137, man, this whole progressive rollout thing that they're doing where it may take time to get to you versus other people who are getting updates and all that, that's annoying. Especially since I tend to be on the waiting period for everything every time. So for those who are not interested in Firefox, I get it. there's been some weird stuff that's happening recently. Feel free to skip to the next topic in the show. That's why there's plenty of topics to choose from. But for those who are interested in what's new with Firefox 138, let's jump in. Profile management is here. Finally, a streamlined way to separate your digital life within Firefox itself. Profile management helps protect your privacy and stay focused by separating your online life into distinct profiles, whether it's for work or school, vacationing, different kinds of work, whatever you want. All that stuff can be done. You can now name your profiles and customize them with avatars and color themes for easy recognition, then quickly switch between them, all while keeping bookmarks, tabs, and browsing history completely separate, which is very, very cool. For years, users have sought an easy way to keep their browser activities distinct with these kinds of profiles. And now, whether it's keeping work or personal information separate, just because you don't want to see it not necessarily like security reasons, but just don't want to see them at the same time, like you're working on something, you don't want to see also the personal stuff, you can now do this with Firefox 138. This is great. I think it is a fantastic update because it is something that should have been done a very long time ago. And for those who don't know, Firefox has had profile system for 20 years. That's right. This is not a new feature. Having access in a way that's not ridiculous, that is the new feature. You used to have to use the command line to activate it or go into the nav bar and type in about:profiles and then launch them from there, which is super awkward, but you could do it. The profile manager has existed for 20 years. As much as Firefox has existed, it's always been there. But most people didn't know that because of activation of it has been very awful forever. All right, let's talk about the other topic. This is a topic that I actually forgot about in Firefox 137 because I didn't talk about it because I didn't notice it for some reason. I don't know. But the highly anticipated tab groups feature was introduced in Firefox 137 and has been improved in the latest release of Firefox 138. This whole rolling out situation is annoying because I have 138 and I don't have the tab groups yet. I mean, you can go into about config and then turn them on, but still, I don't like this progressive rollout thing. Anyway, the new tab groups feature introduced in Firefox 137, this is really cool because you're able to group a bunch of tabs into a single group rather than having changing the profiles. Now you can do a combination of changing multiple groups and then also having multiple groups inside of multiple profiles, which is very cool. But so if you're someone who's juggling multiple projects or research topics or whatever, the ability to reposition your tab groups and also modify various different aspects of that tab group, as in having different color organizations and all sorts of stuff, this is going to be a significant boost to your workflow. But there is actually an article that they posted a blog post about the tab groups thing, and I just wanted to talk about it a little bit. So the blog post is titled, "You Asked, We Built It. Firefox Tab Groups Are Here. What happens when 4,500 or 4,500 people ask for the same feature? Well, at Firefox, we build it. Or we take it away 10 years ago for no apparent reason because we already had it in Firefox a long time ago. Tab groups have been the most requested idea on Mozilla Connect for a very long time. Our community platform, and thanks to thousands of votes and comments and passionate feedback, it's finally here. But this is more than just a feature launch. It's the story of what happens when a community insight, real-world pain points, and a whole lot of curiosity come together." The rest of this blog post is about people talking about it and getting it to happen and all this other stuff. And I want to show you another article about this topic. Now, here's the article I wanted to talk about called "Organize and Manage Your Firefox Tabs Like a Pro with Tab Groups." So back in December of 2015, this article was posted. Hey, look at that. Whose name is that? Oh, that's right. Me, writing an article about Firefox's cool tab group feature, which they removed like a couple months after I made this article in like early 2016. So you had it. You removed it for no reason, but now you're bringing it back and then making a huge like fuss and celebration about bringing this back because the community wanted it when they already had it. And the reason they wanted it is because they had it and you took it away. Anyway, It's just kind of funny to me that I saw this blog post and it's talking about how so great it is that they're bringing this tool because the community asked for it when we were asking you to never get rid of it in the first place. But yeah, they've also added a feature that you can basically have the weather inside of the navigation bar. So for users in the United States, right now it's only in the US, you're getting quick access to the weather just by typing weather in the navigation bar. Users in the United States can trigger the weather suggestions in the address bar simply by typing the term weather or a city name, and it will tell you what the weather is in the city. That is very cool. You don't have to go anywhere to find it, but you can also just, I mean, they have a feature on the, they have a feature on the new tab. So you can just open a new tab and just show the weather there. So you don't really have to do this, but you know, it's kind of cool, I guess. Kind of cool. They've also done a lot of stuff under the hood for various improvements and developer tools. So Firefox on Windows 11 now uses acrylic style menus. No one cares. You can now copy Linux from background tabs using tab strip context menu on Mac OS and Linux. So it's okay because it's on Linux too. Improve the address and credit card autofill experience to better handle forms that update dynamically as users input information. That's nice. I would much rather use a separate tool for my passwords and my credit card filling and stuff like that. Not a big fan of the built-in browser stuff that they all have it and they should have it. They just should be a little better in the security aspects of those things, but maybe someday, maybe someday. And this is not against a hit on Mozilla. The other stuff were arguably hits on Mozilla, but this one is not because, you know, most browsers don't have the best implementation of this sort of stuff. They've also added support for import map integrity field, allowing you to ensure the integrity of dynamically and statically imported modules, which is very good. So there you have it. The key highlights of Firefox version 138. Whether you're excited about better profile management, enhanced tab organization with tab groups, or the various under the hood tweaks, this update will bring a solid set of improvements for you. And remember that some features like profile management and the weather suggestions are part of a progressive rollout, which I seem to never get progressively rolled out to. So keep an eye out if you don't see them right away. And what is your new favorite feature? Let me know in the comments. There's a good chance that the Oregon State University Open Source Lab played a part in your computing experience. Now this vital infrastructure is facing a critical funding challenge. So the OSU Open Source Lab faces imminent shutdown. And I do mean imminent. A cornerstone of the open source community is in serious jeopardy. Unless we can secure somehow as a community $250,000 in committed funds, the OSL will be shut down later this year. The OSU OSL provides hosting and infrastructure for over 500 free and open source projects worldwide, including major players like Drupal, Gentoo Linux, Debian, and many more. Its closure could disrupt the development and the distribution of countless essential open source technologies that rely on the service by individuals and organizations. The OSL isn't just any hosting provider. It has a rich history of supporting pivotal open source projects. They provided hosting for Mozilla Firefox when they needed help in the early days of the project, including hosting the release of Firefox 1.0. It was the home for the Apache Software Foundation, the Linux Foundation, kernel.org, Mozilla for many years, and offers fast and reliable software mirroring for projects. Currently provides infrastructure hosting for projects such as Drupal, Gentoo, Debian, Fedora, PHP BB, OpenID, BuildRoot, BusyBox, Inkscape, Sync, and the list goes on. Virtual machines for x86, ARC 64 for ARM, PPC 64LE are used by many projects for CI and other hosted services. I mean, the OSL has been instrumental in the growth and stability of some of the most important open source projects we use today. Losing this infrastructure would not only impact these projects directly, but also the countless downstream users and developers who depend on them. Now, the funding gap is significant and the timeline to address it is rapidly approaching. So they're requesting $250,000 and they say it's essential to maintain the OSL's core operations, including the salaries of its staff and the support provided by student workers. With a deadline of Wednesday, May 14th of 2025, a swift response is crucial to prevent the lab's closure. So they need $150,000 for staff pay, $65,000 for student pay and other expenses, which would be $35,000. So why am I only telling you about it now when it's only May 14th? Well, they didn't post the blog post asking for request for the donations until like 2 days ago. So anyway, the OSL is reaching out to the community for support in this critical time. So if you can, please reach out directly via donations at osuosl.org. If you're able to help make it possible to continue through this difficult time, you can donate directly to them by visiting their donation page as well. It's important to note that also if you are in the U.S. and you want to do a donation, you can actually get a deduction on your taxes and that sort of stuff because it is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. So just an extra incentive if you'd like to donate. The open source ecosystem thrives on collaboration and mutual support, and this is an opportunity for individuals, corporations, organizations, or anybody to step up and ensure the continued operation of such a vital resource. And I hope that this helps in some way. The potential closure of the OSU OSL serves as a stark reminder of the often unseen infrastructure that underpins the technology we use every day, because there's tons of these kinds of situations where there's tons of different organizations or institutions that are putting a lot of work and in terms of effort and also money to keep these things working. And a lot of the times we don't even know about it. Like first, we don't, you know, give them a lot of credit that they should get, but sometimes we just don't even know that they're doing all of this. Cause I knew they did some of this, but I didn't know everything. If you or your organization benefits from open source software, consider supporting the OSL in their time of need, because every contribution can make a difference in keeping this essential resource alive. Well, of course, we'll continue to follow the story and give you updates as they come. Hopefully, the next time we talk about it, the updates will be good. The open source world can be a wild ride, especially when it comes to software licensing. Everybody loves software licensing topics. Get ready for the latest twist in that and this tale of Redis, the super fast data store, as it revisits its approach to open source. After a controversial licensing change last year, Redis is now offering a more widely accepted open source option, adding the GNU Afero General Public License, or AGPL, as an additional licensing option for Redis, starting with Redis 8. The business said it is moving to a licensing model approved as open source by the Open Source Initiative, or OSI, as the server-side public license, or SSPL version 1, it switched to in March last year, has remained outside of the accepted definition of open source software. The move to SSPL was met with criticisms from the open source community, leading to concerns about its true openness and prompting the Linux Foundation to fork Redis as Valky and other ones. There's been multiple forks. By adding the AGPL, Redis aims to regain trust and offer a license that aligns with the OSI's definition of open source. I did a video about this very topic on my channel last year, so if you'd like to learn more about what happened back then, you can check that out. But for as what's happening now, the company's leadership admits that their previous licensing strategy didn't resonate as they hoped. They say that there hasn't been any movement towards really accepting SSPL as a valid open source license. They go on to say, "We had hoped what would happen is that people would see SSPL as a good license, that it ticked all the boxes, and that even perhaps OSI would reconsider their designation. It seems to us that they weren't going to do that." This quote is from the Redis CEO, Rowan Trollope. I think that's how you say it. Trollope highlights the company's recognition that the SSPL failed to gain acceptance within the open source ecosystem, ultimately influencing their decision to introduce the AGPL version. Although this should not be a surprise, when the SSPL was introduced in 2018 by MongoDB, and basically no one agreed that it was open source compatible, and it's never been changed that I know of, because it's still 1.0. Maybe there's 1.something or whatever, but I don't know why they would expect this to change 6-7 years later for no reason. Now, coinciding with the licensing change is the return of the Redis original creator and also an introduction of a significant new feature. Included in Redis 8 under the new license model will be features including vector sets as one of Redis's core data types. Vector sets offer a native way to store and query high-dimensional embeddings with focus on vector similarity search for AI workloads. the return of Salvatore Sanfilippo, I probably said that wrong, sorry about that, and the introduction of vector sets, a new data type designed for AI applications, signal a renewed focus on innovation and community collaboration within the Redis project. Salvatore himself expressed enthusiasm for the AGBL, stating, "I truly want the code I wrote for the new vector sets data type to be released under an open source license. I'm happy that Redis is open source software again under the terms of the AGBL V3 license." And also, there's a middle ground for remaining critics. While the additional of AGPL is a step towards more openness, some in the community remain cautious. Peter Zaitsev, a co-founder of the open source consultancy Percona, said, "AGPL is like halfway. It's probably the most restrictive, popular open source license out there. Obviously, this is a better approach for customers who would want to stay with Redis. However, he said that for some projects, AGBL would be too restrictive. Now, the AGBL, while OSI approved, has stricter copyleft provisions than more permissive licenses. This quote reflects the nuanced perspective within the open source community, acknowledging the improvement while still not noting the potential limitations for certain use cases. Now, licensing is a very complicated thing. I'm not a big fan of the super permissive license. I know that there's value in it on the enterprise side and stuff like that. So I can understand why the Percona guy would have that statement. But also for me personally, I like the GPL's limitations because it means that it's harder for companies to do some weird stuff that and historically has happened quite a bit. So that's just my preference. I think that it's a very complicated topic, and I'm talking about it in a very overview style, but that's just how I see it. The saga of Redis's licensing is a fascinating case to study in the challenges of balancing open source ideals with the realities of commercial interests, because it's very complicated. The addition of the AGBL is a significant development, but the long-term impact on the community and the adoption of Redis 8 remains to be seen. But of course, we're going to keep an eye on this as it unfolds, especially considering, basically Redis wants a redo when it comes to open source. And it did not turn out very well last year when they changed this. So some people are going to be skeptical about like, well, maybe you'll just change it later again anyway. So who knows? I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for this. And if you'd like to learn more, you can check links in the show notes. And of course, subscribe to be updated. The Red Hat Summit and Ansible Fest are just around the corner in Boston. This is happening where there's a lot of cool stuff that is packed with the agenda. There's a bunch of must-see content, including me. I'll be at the Red Hat Summit this year. And feel free to find me on the expo hall floor and introduce yourself. We can talk about all sorts of things Linux related. Did I just call myself must-see content? Huh. Okay, yeah, sure. Let's go with it. So let's talk about what's going to be at the Red Hat Summit. So the Ansible keynote was going to be about automation in the age of AI. The main stage keynote at Ansible Fest is always a highlight, and this year's promise is an insightful look into the future of automation. For those focused on the evolution of automation tools, there's also specific breakout sessions, which will provide a roadmap for what's next with like the future of Red Hat Ansible automation and all sorts of stuff. The event offers a wide array of sessions catering to various levels of automation experience and specific interests. So there's getting started with IT automation and for need to expand automation implementation in your organization. And if you want to know how AI and automation can work together, there's a bunch of different sessions. There's so many really cool sessions. I'm super excited. The only thing that's bad about going to these kinds of conferences is that there is so much to do that you can't do it all. It's impossible. Like you need to be able to be three different people to go to everything you want to do. And unfortunately, that does not work in reality. Red Hat Summit and Ansible Fest look like they are shaping up to be can't-miss events for anyone involved in open source IT and automation. And I was able to go to last year's Red Hat Summit, and it was very cool. It was in Denver, and it was just fascinating. And I can't wait for this next one because the Red Hat Enterprise Linux 10 beta is out. So I'm guessing that RHEL 10 is going to be announced at this year's summit. So I'm looking forward to seeing what's all there. And there's just a lot of cool stuff I'm expecting. So if you're going to be in Boston, let me know because I'm going to be in Boston for the Red Hat Summit of this year. So check it out. For more information, you'll find links in the show notes. Thanks for watching this episode of This Week in Linux. If you like what I do here on this show and want to be kept up to date with what's going on in the Linux and open source world, then be sure to subscribe. And of course, remember to like that smash button. If you'd like to support the show and the Tux Digital Network, then consider becoming a patron by going to tuxdigital.com/membership. We're going to get a bunch of cool perks like access to the patron-only section of our Discord server and much, much more, including access to the patron-only Skybox, which happens during the live stream we do every week on Fridays. And if you didn't know that, yes, we stream the show live. You can watch the show live unedited and just lots of extra content because I can't do it efficiently. The edited version is very efficient, but the recording, not so much. But you can join me in the Skybox by becoming a patron and going to tuxdigital.com/membership. You can also join me in the patron-only post show that happens every week after the show by going to tuxdigital.com/membership. And if you'd like to support the show in other ways, you can do so by getting some t-shirts or a bunch of other swag from the store at tuxdigital.com/store. We have the This Week in Linux shirt that I'm wearing right now, and there's also the Linux is Everywhere shirt, as well as many more, tuxdigital.com/store. I'll see you next time for another episode of Your Source for Linux Good News. Thanks again for watching. I'm Michael Tennell. I hope you're doing swell. Be sure to ring that notification bell, and until next time, I bid you farewell.